From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch, and Nehal Tusi, Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The fallout continues from the Easter Sunday bombings in Sri Lanka as officials continue to count the dead and wounded and seek suspects in the attacks who are believed to still be at large. In the wake of the recently released Mueller report, Democrats in the House of Representatives have demanded records and testimony from the Trump administration, both of which President Donald Trump has so far refused to provide. Former President Joe Biden officially entered the crowded 2020 presidential race as the frontrunner in most polls. Russian President Vladimir Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met to discuss a range of issues, including the ongoing negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea on denuclearization. And U.S. President Donald Trump has decided to end exemptions from sanctions for countries still buying oil from Iran. Panelists, a lot to discuss. Let's start with the Sri Lanka church bombings. The death toll, I hear, has been revised downward. A grim reason for that is that there were so many serious injuries that it was hard to determine the number of bodies there. So the count has been revised down, but it's still in the hundreds. 58 was the last count I saw under arrest in an investigation that has an ever-widening circle. Nehal, I'll start with you. Where do we stand now in terms of the last thing you've heard as far as the death count and where the investigation stands?
The last thing I heard was roughly around 250 dead. What's really tragic in so many of these cases is you often never really know how many people have died. Yeah. But what's also happening is that there's a lot of concern about reprisals. The Muslim community in Sri Lanka, which really in the past hasn't been known for this sort of extremism or having this sort of communal tensions, is now really worried that they're going to be targeted. And, you know, the government has arrested a bunch of people, but I don't really get the sense that their investigation is very targeted or necessarily very on point. What you often see after these sorts of attacks is the governments go out and they just arrest anybody they see on the street. And so we don't really know yet how close they are to getting any sort of justice.
So really casting a wide net. Steve, there were a number of organizations that claimed responsibility for this, a couple of local terrorist organizations, if you will. Also, ISIS has claimed responsibility. The local organizations, again, is a little bit different than the civil war type of violence that we saw. This is not involving Tamil Tigers or anything like that. And then you have ISIS, which was supposedly on the run and basically without a heartbeat. Talk a little bit about the organizations that are involved in this.
I think, as you point out, that it's still not clear who carried out it. And I think that's actually another kind of weird similarity of terrorist attacks is you don't always know who committed it.
Yes,
you do sometimes
have
multiple claims of responsibility, and it's up to, you know, investigators to really tie it together. I think one very clear issue with Sri Lanka is that they were not really paying attention, and you can tell that by the fact that those top security officials were immediately fired. And you had India who said that they had concerns that this something like this was about to happen and gave a very specific warning that was not
heeded.
Warnings
that were ignored.
I think one other thing about kind of terrorism more generally is that they try to look for the weak spots, the weak links, the people who are not paying attention. I think as terrorism becomes a worldwide phenomenon, I mean, it already is, but that increasingly you see pockets of the world that perhaps maybe you wouldn't necessarily expect, but just sort of the easiest place to cause the maximum damage. And I think that's what happened here.
No, we have, again, ongoing investigations. We have a country that's still on high alert, as it's suspected that a number of the perpetrators are still at large. Is there any sign that this is coming to any type of resolution in terms of at least the investigation and the search?
I think the government of Sri Lanka would like you to think that. They keep arresting people. But I think it will be quite a while before we know for sure who was behind this, who helped plan, who inspired it. I mean, sometimes ISIS claims responsibility for attacks that they say they inspired. So this is the type of thing that I think is going to really drag on for years. And frankly, the justice systems in some of these South Asian countries are not known for being very speedy anyway.
Mm-hmm. Were you struck by the number of people that seem to be involved in this attack? This wasn't a few bad actors. It seems to be scores of people involved in the planning of it, including some people who were very high up in society.
Right. There were some prominent, apparently, allegedly, the children, some of the children of a prominent merchant were caught up in this, alleged to have been involved in this attack. Yeah. So, I mean, this is the type of thing that does require coordination, does require certain linkages. But then there's also, you know, people who may have unwittingly been involved. They didn't know that this was going to happen. So the question is, you know, who is at the core and what are they planning next?
I have some experience in Sri Lanka. I spent several years there when I was living in Southeast Asia, working with the central bank. And I can tell you that it's just a tragic thing when you see that in such a beautiful country with such wonderful people to have anything like this happen. Just, it's heartbreaking on a personal level for me. Let's move to the Trump administration. Trump is defying Congress yet again. I think it's going to be sort of the watchword of the rest of the his administration. Emboldened by his perception of exoneration in the Mueller report, President Trump has staked out a very defiant position against congressional oversight. Some of the moves that we've seen are suing the House Oversight Committee Chair Elijah Cummings in response to the Cummings subpoenaing certain records and individuals. President Trump is barring or asking the current aides not to testify in Congress, including former White House counsel Don McGahn. You have Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who is refusing to hand over the tax returns of Donald Trump. This is sort of an outright just declaration of, if not war, certainly battle against congressional oversight. Steve, start with you. Unprecedented in your view, the stance?
Yeah, I think so. Look, there's always been flare-ups between the White House and Congress. I think Republicans on the Hill would also remind people of the Obama administration in certain instances, also kind of ignoring their wishes. But the scale of it, the multiple areas of resistance that basically they're shutting down, basically every kind of investigative cooperation with Congress simultaneously, I think that's the part that's unprecedented, that you have all these things. And also, you had the tweet from the president saying that he would bring impeachment to the Supreme Court, you know, where the Constitution imagines no role for that other than the participation of the Supreme Court justice in the Senate trial. So when you look at the scope of it, what you said is right, that it's total war from the White House. It's Trump saying no more. You can tell he's very upset with the people who participated with the Mueller inquiry in the report.
Yeah. Don McGahn seemingly in particular.
In particular, who I think even at the time people are wondering, well, why is McGahn spending so much time testifying? And he absolutely gave up the goods. But I think the key point is that determination has been made in the White House, no more cooperation unless you can somehow pry it out of us. And they're going to fight probably as long as I can to do that.
And isn't it so interesting that they don't want to cooperate on an investigation after they say they've been exonerated? So it's like, if you're exonerated and you did nothing wrong and you have nothing to hide, then why are you not willing to cooperate?
Well, the president says he's been the most open president with the most open administration in history. Do the facts bear that out, in your opinion?
No. No.
Just no. Well, they did provide answers, the answers that the Mueller report requested. There were hours
answers,
and hours of—
mind you, but that Mueller himself thought were not accurate.
And the president wouldn't testify.
And the president did not testify.
And can I just add one more thing?
Please.
In a way, in one sense, Trump has been the most open president in history, because through his Twitter feed, we get a look into his thoughts, his emotions, his sentiments. So in that sense, yes. But in the traditional sense.
In traditional sense, no, certainly not.
Right.
It seems to me that the appointment of William Barr was kind of a pivot point in this administration. When we look at the initial lineup, if you will, of the Trump administration, you saw a lot of people who were thought to serve as sort of guardrails for the administration to warn off the president from his own maybe worst instincts. And all of those people, from Jeff Sessions to you name it, basically the entire administration that served in that type of role, McMaster and Cohen, all sorts of people, are all gone. So I think you're looking at the president's Trump presidency 2.0, and this is basically the president unchained, unguarded, unfiltered, and unrestrained. And now you have an attorney general who seems to be, rather than a softening agent, he's someone who is more of an instigator and an enabler in the president's policies and his approach of obstinance and obstruction against congressional oversight.
I will add one thing, though. Barr, the statute about the special counsel statute does not require the attorney general to turn over the report. That was a choice. Now, every other decision, every other response to Congress has been very much along lines that Trump approves of. He certainly, the way Barr is suggesting that, yes, that they spied on him, and you using those words, the way he held that press conference ahead of the release of the report. So you have all of that. But at the end of the day, he did let for release the most important thing that he was not under legal obligation to do. And so whether that's Barr playing a clever game or not, I mean, the pressure of him, if he had not released it, I think would have been tremendous. But there is a case to be made that maybe Barr is saying certain things, but actually doing others that are more consistent with a guardrail. But he's trying to kind of give in where he thinks he can not cause damage, but allow the process to proceed where he thinks it's important.
Nahal, I want to frame something for you and then get your response to it. President Trump, in his business career, has made a tactic of being litigious and also ignoring the lawsuits of others into a somewhat successful strategy for him. Obviously, we're talking about government, not business. And as I look at my history book, I see that one of the articles of impeachment against President Richard Nixon was ignoring subpoenas. That was one of the articles of impeachment. That was a reason for impeachment. Would you accept the argument that the president's behavior post-Mueller might be just as strong an argument for impeachment as anything that you find inside the report?
I think that he is not helping his case when it comes to impeachment. And I think that the Democratic base in particular is looking to their leadership in the House to move on impeachment. And even though that leadership, Pelosi has basically ruled it out. When Trump does this stuff post-Mueller report, to them it's just more evidence that he is going to still continue to try to obstruct or do whatever. But let's not forget something. One of the fascinating things that Trump has exposed about our governance system is how much of it is based on norms as opposed to laws and rules that can be enforced. You know, people just never thought that a president would do this to Congress. Congress thought it was more powerful than apparently it's turning out to be. I mean, one of the most fascinating things we're seeing is how weak Congress actually really is. And this is just something that, you know, going forward, we're going to have to see if future administrations and future Congresses try to rectify, to put more of these things as legal requirements that are enforceable, as opposed to just norms, because you expect people to behave in a way that is consistent with U.S. tradition.
Legislation rather than expectation. I like that. Great point. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. Did you know you can download the program? It's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch, and Nahal Tusi, Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome back. So, leading in the polls without declaring, Joe Biden has been in that position for quite some time. Now, he has officially entered the 2020 presidential race, running, I believe, for the third time as a presidential candidate. I'll start with you, Steve. I was fascinated by how he made the announcement, not the method by video. A number of candidates have done that. But the message in the video, I think, was quite different than virtually every other candidate that was out there. Your thoughts?
Actually, I was struck by that as well. And in fact, wrote a story saying that I thought it was very interesting that he deliberately singled out Trump and Trump's really tolerance, I guess, for bigotry in his infamous comment in Charlottesville. And that does make him stand out in the Democratic field. And really, it's Biden's main selling point. This is his third run for the presidency. And he's not really a person known for policy ideals, so he doesn't bring that to the table. You wouldn't necessarily go to a 76-year-old former vice president as someone you would think would be the most able person to sit in the Oval Office. So his argument why you would vote for him over anybody else is this idea that, number one, that Trump's behavior is no longer acceptable, but that Biden is uniquely able to combat that. And so really, that is the message of his entire candidacy, because why else would you support him? If you want different policy ideas on the left, look, you're going to go to either Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. If you want just a modern leader, I think maybe you would go for Kamala Harris or Pete Buttigieg. But if you actually want to win the 2020 election, is what Joe Biden is saying, you need one to say why it is that you don't like Donald Trump and find somebody who can appeal to the people who previously voted for Donald Trump. And that's Biden's whole proposition.
Nahal, when I look at the whiteboard for Joe Biden, if you had just one category for pros and cons, on the pro side, you could have experience. And on the con side, you'd have experience. Can we elaborate on that one?
Exactly. I mean, he has a long track record, legislation, comments, past presidential runs that people can point to and say, hey, look, remember how you treated Anita Hill? Hey, look, remember your comments about criminal justice and the system there and how that could resonate among minorities now. There are a lot of things that Joe Biden has done that could come back to haunt him. And sure, he might be the front runner in some polls right now. But in a sense, if you're one of his Democratic challengers, you're thinking, OK, well, the only way he has to go is down. Right. So how do you make this like a war of attrition on Joe Biden's poll numbers? Like if I was Joe Biden, I'd be like, all right, so how am I going to prevent myself from losing support even as I'm trying to gain more support? It's like the whole, like, you know, if you're at the top, you're going to be the target for everyone.
Exactly. Steve, how do the Democratic candidates, whether it's Joe Biden, whether it's Bernie Sanders, whether it's someone else, how do they prevent setting themselves up as a circular firing squad? Because if the goal ultimately is to defeat the incumbent president, this is going to be a long and apparently a little bit vicious battle between these candidates.
It absolutely will be. I think that's a very salient point, and I'm not sure that they can prevent that. And that's the process. If you're going to have 20-some candidates, well, of course, what are they going to do? Say how much they like each other?
But do you remember that the beginning of the 2008 campaigns, there were a lot of candidates there, what we thought were a lot of candidates, ranging from Hillary Clinton, the obvious sort of establishment choice, to in some way remember Representative Dennis Kucinich, who was the Bernie Sanders of his day, sort of like the Boy Wonder version, but very much on the super progressive and liberal side. But they were all very kind to each other until you got to the final two, which was Obama and Hillary Clinton. Is that not possible for them this time?
I think it's going to be difficult for them not to do it. I think, look, the also you have to look at the personalities involved. So the Bernie Sanders camp, as we know, is they are very, I think, aggressive is almost a euphemism, but they are fighters. And so is Elizabeth Warren, kind of in a different way. The Biden camp has a lot of former Obama people. You put them all in a room, they're willing to mix it up. I don't think there's going to be this sort of gentle, high-minded debate. I think they're going to really get into it. I think already we've seen some, you've had Elizabeth Warren, for instance, attacking Biden's support for credit card companies. You've had Bernie Sanders do a fundraising message pointing out that, without using his name, that Biden's first fundraising was at the home of a lobbyist. So you have all these different things. That's going to continue for the next year and a half.
But I don't think you're going to see the type of thing you saw with the Republicans this last time around in 2016. I don't think you're going to see any of the Democratic candidates giving one another nasty nicknames. I think if they are going to ding each other, it's probably going to be less personal and more about policy and you know, things like fundraising and lobbying and things like that.
Well, to bring the discussion full circle, I thought that the opening salvo from Joe Biden in his video was an entreaty to African-American voters. And you cannot win the Democratic nomination without African-American voters. And as it stands, Bernie Sanders is running at about 50%. the polls and African-American vote with African-American candidates who are running far behind him. So I think he knows, he may not know where the party is going, but I think he knows exactly where it is now. So it'll be interesting to see which magnetic direction is more powerful in the months coming up. Let's move to the North Korean-Russia summit. Russian President Vladimir Putin and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met to discuss a range of issues, including the ongoing negotiations for denuclearization. On the agenda for that one?
Well, you know, my understanding is that there was not much of substance that came out of it, but that essentially this was a chance for Putin to show that he is relevant and for Kim to show that even though President Trump claims that he and Kim are in love, that Kim has other suitors as well. But, you know, it's just one of those instances where you see the Russians showing up whenever they see the Americans doing something major. The Russians show up somewhere and they're like, hey, we have a role. We can do something, too. But as far as we know, there's nothing that they're offering the North yet that could really make them an alternative power, especially given that the U.S. has thousands of troops in South Korea and that that's what the North Koreans are really worried about.
Steve, I love the love triangle analogy. I was and thinking about this, thinking more about triangularization in terms of Henry Kissinger and Vladimir Putin positioning himself as the new Henry Kissinger and the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Your thoughts?
Really, it speaks to, though, is that the U.S. and North Korea, under Trump, really, embarked on this new policy path. And it stuck. That's really the background to the meeting. That's why Kim was so willing to meet Putin. Right? And, of course, Putin sees it as a good way, again, to project Russia's foreign policy, which basically is not to be the United States. One interesting thing I thought that Putin said, that if North Korea denuclearized, that there would have to be some sort of international defense guarantees, which is probably kind of both correct, but also a bit of a move, I think, in a positive direction if they really believe that. But really, I think this is Kim wanting to get the U.S. talks back on track. I'm not sure that he's willing to make the concessions that would be necessary to do that. I think Kim's goal is to get rid of the sanctions and keep the nuclear program. I mean, that's
good luck.
It. Good luck with that. But that's what he's trying to do, and we'll see how far it gets.
Indeed, we will. We'll finish with U.S. Ending sanctions against five countries who import Iranian oil. The White House said that waivers for China, India, Japan, South Korea, and Turkey would expire in May, after which they could face U.S. sanctions themselves. Steve, I'll stay with you.
Yeah, well, oil prices have climbed. They're about over $70 a barrel, the international benchmark. And yeah, it's an important move globally. Now, people do expect if China and India aren't getting their oil from Iran, that they'll go, that Saudi Arabia will be able to pump out more. And that's why maybe prices haven't, you know, skyrocketed. But it certainly is a significant step. And in a way, it sort of reduces, if there are some other problems, it reduces the available spare capacity in the system. So I think it's sort of, people have handled it fine, other than in Iran, where they are very upset. They have threatened the key waterway.
The Strait of Hormuz.
Yes, thank you. It just,
they make that right now.
Without coffee, I couldn't come up with it. But, you know, so there's the potential that maybe, not that Iran would block Saudi output altogether, they don't have that capability, but could they disrupt it? Can they delay it? Yeah, they do have that.
No, I'll give you the final word on this.
You know, this is definitely a move against Iran. I mean, the administration wants to shut off all revenue sources to the Iranian regime. But it's also a move against other countries in a way. It's basically telling other countries, if you do business with Iran, you're going to get face sanctions from the U.S. And, you know, some countries are going to be scared about that. But then there's other countries that don't take kindly to that sort of bullying. China, for instance, you know, right now they're basically saying, you know, we don't appreciate you guys treating us this way, and we're going to make our own foreign policy and our own economic policy in our own way. So I think it really remains to be seen whether major countries like China and India actually do follow the U.S. demands and stop their oil imports from Iran. And if they don't, that gives Iran a lifeline that it hopes that will sustain it at least through one term of the Trump administration. And the Iranians are definitely hoping that there isn't a second term.
Our thanks to Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch, and Nahal Tusi, Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. This program is produced by Patrice Martin. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.